It's Wednesday, April 16th, 2008, and you're listening to episode 98 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 55 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Matt.
My name is John.
My name is Luke.
And my name is Chris.
Oh, crap! Chris is finally on the podcast.
Believe it or not.
Welcome aboard, Chris.
Thank you.
Hello.
He's only been a host for like 3 months and never showed up on an episode thanks to problems with his equipment.
Yeah, I heard that he has problems with equipment. You try Cialis, buddy? Maybe some Levitra? Get a little bit of that hot vagina flame action?
Oh, I've got the two tubs in the wilderness, so I've got that going on.
Hey, man, ED is no laughing matter.
Especially if you've got two tubs in the wilderness.
Oh. I have seen a toilet in the wilderness. To this day, I don't know what the story is behind that, but I was walking down the road once.
I think I know what the story in it is.
And there was this toilet in perfectly good shape, sitting straight up, all of its parts assembled, just in the middle of woods.
Wait, all the parts of, did you try it out?
Did it flush?
Because that'd be pretty amazing.
The lid was on and all that stuff. It's not like it just fell out of a truck and was shattered laying in the middle of the ground.
Some people will hunt on anything. You just need something comfortable. And seriously, what's more comfortable than a comfortable John?
That's true. I mean, even if it doesn't flush, you're probably not going to be using it all that often.
I don't know. If my tree stand gave me hemorrhoids,
that's what I heard about you
bad.
This weekend, actually, that you're comfortable
John. I am indeed.
Speaking of comfortable John this past weekend, let's talk New York.
New York.
This episode, we really are after the New York trip, and the con was great, Icon 27.
It was absolutely amazing.
Got to do some great panels, meet some really cool people, several of our listeners. Unfortunately, we only got out to see the city for a couple hours one night.
Yes. Little did we know, Long Island is relative to Manhattan as, we'll do something regional. St. Louis is to maybe a Columbia and a half.
You're
train riding the length of half of a Midwestern state.
It's a 90-minute train
to
ride.
See, you know, all the movies and stuff, the only experience I have with New York is through various media.
A slight time delay and montage of subs walking.
Kurt
Russell trying
town.
To get out.
What actually happens is somebody's puking on the floor of your train and then running away from it.
Was that you?
No. Okay. That was some guy that was literally running through our train, puke, and kept going.
You know, I say this whole thing was unfortunate because the four of us that went, me, John, my sister Christine and her husband Adam
and Christopher.
The ones of us that came up there. We have traveled pretty far and wide all over the world: South America, Australia, Europe. Yet none of us have ever been to New York, which is really surprising because when you start traveling, that's a pretty common place to at least pass through.
Yeah, and I have family there, and I've still never been up there.
So we got to go to Manhattan just for a couple hours. Went down to the Heartland Brewery and to a
Red Rocker West, which was amazing.
Was Sammy Hagar there?
What's that?
Sorry, that's an obscure reference. Sammy Hagar, Red Rocker. Go ahead, please continue.
That's not obscure.
You're talking to St. Louisans. We know about the Red Rocker.
This is the one town in which it is safe to say that Hagar was just as good as, David Lee Roth.
David Lee Roth.
Yeah, the big classic rock station in town each year has like a rock and roll survivor, and he always wins. They actually had to take him off of it because he won it too many.
He and Rush are out this year, I think.
Yeah, Rush too.
They got retired
yeah,
Rush down here.
It was good. It was this kind of sort of softcore Coyote Ugly place.
I got to throw out two big thanks. We met a bunch of listeners up there, all really cool people. I remember meeting Tim. He was a great guy. But there's two people in particular that we owe a huge Fear the Boot thanks to, now that our thank yous have a brand name.
Well, I can think of two as well.
The first the same two. Is James.
Yes.
The guy who sponsored us being up there, took care of
us. Dreg in gamer parlance.
Yeah, Dreg. And he got us on all kinds of panels, got us meeting people. He was the one that I believe sponsored us for the Robin D. Laws Award.
He was, I believe, the only person in the cons administration who knew gaming left from right. So
right.
We salute him.
Ooh. And so big, huge thanks to James for everything you did. It was absolutely awesome. It was great meeting you. He said he was going to come down for Fear the Con too. So we hope to see him on our side of things here within the next, it's be like 9 or 10 or 11 months. But still, we hope to catch you then. The second person we owe a big thanks to is Christopher.
Yes.
This gentleman came down for Fear the Con 1, and he was...
flew in from New York for our dorky little 12-hour gaming party.
Right, and he loved the reception he got, so he offered to do the same for us and show us some New York hospitality. And this was the man who met us out there in Manhattan after we took the train out there, helped us navigate the subways, took us around town, showed us a bunch of places, really great guy. Had a lot of fun hanging out with him. So, Christopher, thank you. And also a big congratulations, because while we were up there, we found out that Christopher is going to become a father.
Yep.
So,
nice. Congrats.
Big Very thank nice. You and a big congratulations to Christopher.
Speaking of babies, I'm looking at our award here on the wall, and it is nice and shiny.
I know. It's the one decoration down here.
That is true.
I stroked it very slowly.
Well, you need to put the Fear the Con thing up from Martian Bob next to it.
Well, I've lived here about 3 or 4 years, and so far that is the only decoration I have hung up anywhere in the entire house. Carl has put up a couple, but I have put up absolutely nothing so far. I need to change that.
Well, I think you've started. It's a good beginning.
Well, I guess the Bon Jovi poster's got to go somewhere.
Yeah. Last thing about Icon, as I said earlier, we went up there with my sister and her husband, and I want to talk about her husband for a second. Now, this guy is not at all what you would think of as a likely gamer. Big jock, into all kinds of sports, in good shape.
Social skills.
Oh, just way down on the stereotypes.
All the times we say that all these stereotypes are BS, but here's this guy.
Let's reinforce it as much as possible.
He's never touched gaming. He's not a big reader of sci-fi or fantasy novels. He's not into all kinds of dorky stuff. The video games that he plays are a lot of sports video games and shooters and such. This is not the kind of guy that you would pay for a tabletop gamer.
And at the end of the weekend, he's asking Dan when the game can start.
Yeah,
we saw a conversion.
We converted him in the course of one
week.
He was
on the
board. Hallelujah.
We made a civilization cultural flip. Successfully.
My sister was mostly just aghast at the freak show.
Gamer culture.
But this guy,
your sister was scared.
Yeah.
It was funny.
I can't blame her. I mean, cons always bring out strange people at their strangest. So, but anyway, I want to talk
quick.
Well, that just means that he was a geek.
Yes, there were furries.
He had an inner geek, and he just needed it to come out. It's always been there. You just helped him bring it out.
You just stroked it.
Well, here's the thing about that. During one of the panels, he actually asked us a question about why gaming is stuck within its subculture. And I'm paraphrasing the question. But I kind of turned it around to him and I said, let me ask you. You're a guy who's into creative stuff, but really has never made that foray into geek culture. And now suddenly that you've been exposed to it, you're interested in it. Why the change? You know what his response was?
Sex got boring.
Hi, she's married to my sister.
No, dude, I'm in gaming for the sake.
I don't want to know a damn thing. They're like my grandparents. They never had sex. My nephew just sprung up from the earth. We know nothing
Fair
about
enough.
That. But the thing that he said was, because I asked him, why is it that you've got these kind of potential interests, but you never really tried any stuff? And his response was, because of all the stereotypes. That he pretty much thought that all gaming was, and his exact phrase was something to the effect of, it's a bunch of guys sitting around in their basements wearing black capes. So,
it's not. What are you talking about? I've got mine on right now.
Yeah, and I tried to sell him the difference between LARPing and role-playing. But, that aside, this is something that everyone kind of needs to think about, that our job as gamers, if we want to grow this hobby, or to use a phrase Christopher used, to leave this hobby in better shape than when we found it, the biggest thing that we have to do is we go out there and evangelize role-playing games, so to speak, is break these stereotypes to show people that gaming has an intellectual and a creative aspect, and it doesn't require being an antisocial freak to engage in. And the media is going to be no help here.
No.
Our portrayals in any kind of media, print, news.
This is media.
Now, I have to say, though, to what you're saying, though, Dan, first of all, you're dead on. That's exactly, absolutely what needs to be done. But related to that, because of my position being in the media, I've had that ability to try and put that positive spin on there. We staged, when D&D had its 35th anniversary just a couple years ago, we staged a news story because one of the reporters at the station was married to one of the guys in my group. And so I kept pushing to get the story done. And when we did it, it was very well done, portrayed us all in a very positive light, had good visuals, and everybody sitting around the table didn't look like any of those stereotypes. And I was in the story as well, and I made sure, to put as positive of a spin on it as I was able to. And it really
came out
good. Well,
you're as visual a man as they come, Chris.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. So, but I know what you mean. And going along with what you're saying there too, is gamers have to overcome that gamer shame that we've talked about before. at work now, I'll still bring it up, and I can tell that it makes some people uncomfortable when I bring it up, and they just kind of brush me off, you know, just to humor me. But it's a constant fight against those stereotypes.
You know, Chris, I'm curious, when you were going to make this special, what were the kinds of questions and issues that you guys worked through while you were designing it?
Do you mean you're talking about the story?
Yeah, your story.
You essentially have a minute and a half to really try and put this all in a good light. And we just portrayed it as a bunch of adult. We were all, you know, adult males, and we would get together, you know, for a weekly game session. And we brought out the Dwarven Forge setup stuff, you know, so we had good visuals. We brought out the D&D miniatures because it's TV, obviously. You can't just see a bunch of guys sitting around a table with paper. So we had set all that up there. And I guess, you know, issues, we just talked more about the fact that this is a hobby that we've all enjoyed. It's a good social gathering. It was just a really enjoyable thing to do. You know, it beats just, you know, sitting around watching TV or watching movies. You know, we have the chance to interact with each other, hang out with each other for years on end, create good stories, and just have a good time. It's just another way of recreation.
I've seen some people who are really evangelizing the hobby more than the average gamer, because the average gamer just plays with their group, occasionally brings in somebody new, and that's about it. But one of the guys who's on a few forums that I frequent is, I can't remember his actual name, but he goes by the handle Blue Sponge, and he runs a role-playing game set in the library for teenagers. So teenagers sign up, come in, he runs a game for them, and it's the library sponsors it. It's an after-school special type thing, and he's had great success with it. They did a he was in a newspaper story a while back. I need to find the details on that, but it sounds like it was a roaring success. He ran 50 fathoms, and it sounds like a lot of people had fun, and he keeps kids busy.
He too can win the Robin D. Laws Award for excellence in gaming.
So since this is an after-school special, did he have to deal with teen pregnancy or underage drinking?
Probably so. I think that's probably it.
Well, that's all that happened in my D&D games when I was 16.
Well, I mean, and talking about selling games to non-gamers, too, I mean, for my wife, as she puts it, you know, I'll talk about, I mean, are you ever embarrassed that I game or do stuff like that? She's like, look, there's a lot of stuff you could be doing with your time. You could be going to strip clubs. You could be just hanging out in bars. You go to basements and sit around a table with your friends. I think that's okay by me. So I'm like, you know, that's a good way to look at it.
Which is true, but just because it's a safe hobby doesn't mean that it becomes an enticing hobby to outsiders.
No, exactly.
Yeah. Well, you could play with dolls all day and people would be like, well, he's not going to hurt himself, but he's friggin' nuts.
Well, I mean, really, everybody has the power to be an ambassador for gaming.
I have a hat.
You have a hat?
I have my ambassador hat. It looks like a big Levitra flame. It's awesome.
Excellent. You and that Levitra flame.
I love it. It's so hot.
I'm going to buy you a tub for your birthday.
Ooh, that was bad.
I'm going to look at it again. You're telling me it's a vulva.
Yeah, completely. Okay. Never saw that when they brought it up.
Wait, see, now that is enticing.
Not if it's made out of fire.
Getting back to one thing that you'd said there, Dan, back when I was also in college, there were four Phi Ed majors on the floor. I lived in the dorms on campus. And I was able to convince all of them to go ahead and give D&D a try. And these are all four jocks. They were all Phi Ed majors. And, you know, not to discredit them, they all made fighters, but...
Barbarians? Was it second edition?
This was second edition, so they all made fighters.
That's why.
And quite honestly, they had a great time. I mean, they had some very strange behaviors at the table, but yet still, they had a blast, and they were all playing fighters, and I catered to what they wanted to do. You know, I kind of built our adventures around...
Kill things with swords?
And that was basically what they did, and they had a good time with it, but they enjoyed it.
Hey, we just killed a dragon, and they smack each other's asses, and...
Knuckle
punch?
Actually, no,
like
actually,
on Army 2.
Actually, what they would do is occasionally...
Don't Kool-Aid on the GM at the end of the campaign.
During quiet moments, honestly, they would expose themselves to each other. And they would say, hey, I'm not kidding. We'd stand up and say, hey, Rich, take a look at my nuts. And he'd stretch his sack out. I'm not kidding.
People on that side of the hobby think that we're intimidating with our big nerd culture, but then they're flashing their balls at one another. That's a little intimidating, too.
Yeah. And they could get some good stretching as well. Yeah.
I can proudly say that in my entire 20-year gaming history, no one's balls have been displayed at the gaming table.
No, never at the gaming table, but on Xbox Live, as I've reported, I've seen far too many.
Yeah,
flashing your nuts is one of those things that if you do it too much at all, it really loses its effectiveness.
Well, you just become desensitized to it.
Well, if you do it once, it can be terrifying.
Yeah, but it shouldn't be done.
I wish I could say I'd never seen it at my table. We actually had to institute a dress code.
Are you serious?
Of your shorts need to be longer, dude.
Or wear some boxers or something. Come on.
This is a role-play game, not the birdcage. John, I'm curious, though. What are the situations where it's appropriate to show your nuts?
Well, let's say you're a sophomore in college. And this girl has been bothering you for a year and a half now. She's going on this whole intense attraction, falling into bottomless hatred, falling into attraction again. You've seen it. And she implies you don't have a dick. And you say, yes, I do have a dick. And if you don't go away right now, I'm going to show it to you. And then that goes back and forth for 10 minutes until you're forced to flash it.
Because really, no, I'm not going to go there because that's just going to go to a very bad place.
I've got all kinds of jokes. It's gonna, all of them are going to offend somebody.
I've done it for beads before, but that's
I didn't know there was like a reverse Mardi Gras action. Was that here in St. Louis?
No, because that would be illegal.
It's not illegal down there?
Never mind.
All righty, getting on to something more useful with role-playing games. We're going to talk today...
I tip my ambassador hat to you,
oh,
sir.
Actually, before we get started on that, while you guys were at ICON the week before, I was actually at Mid-South Con in Nashville, which was a very nice con. I just wanted to throw a quick shout-out. Very excellent con suite. They had really great food, lots of people in costumes, very enthusiastic administrative people, and lots of organized play.
Did you come back with an award?
No.
Then stop talking.
I'm just saying it was a good con. Good job.
Did you go pimp out in Manhattan for an hour?
Or Memphis. Memphis, not Nashville. Never mind. Nashville's great, too.
And that's why they didn't give you an award.
That's right.
I actually would have gone to Memphis if I hadn't been an ICON, because that's where my dad's from. And there's a lot of really cool stuff down there, like Liberty Island and or
Graceland.
No, not Graceland.
We went to Beale Street.
Or is it Mud Island? Little around Mud
Beale Street's always a good time, especially
Graceland?
When they get the goats
no,
drunk.
No, not Graceland.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I did an entire tour of Memphis and never saw a single damned Elvis thing. All we did was like Civil War and history stuff. And
hey, Mojo
really
Nixon
cool.
says Elvis is everywhere. I don't believe what you're saying.
I've gone to Shiloh a couple times, but never Memphis.
It's actually harder to go to Vegas and avoid Elvis than it is to go to Memphis.
Oh, I don't doubt that at all.
Avoiding Elvis in Memphis is all about what neighborhood you're in.
Right, exactly. So, all righty. RPG topic for today, destructive players or players that create destructive characters. You know those guys that every time they join the game, it seems like it is their conscious or subconscious intention to somehow destroy everything that you have built.
They create Chads?
Wow.
We had spent all this time talking about how to avoid that.
You come out swinging with it.
But yeah, that's what we're talking about.
Pretty much.
It's like bullfighting, and all of our thought is, how do we dodge the bull? And the first thing he does is burst through that red blanket and gore us straight on.
I wasn't at dinner with you guys.
No, you
weren't. You were in our hearts,
you didn't
so.
Get the briefing, that's true.
Okay, so what can hypothetical disruptive players do to, say, ruin your game so that they can be the GM and then not run a campaign?
This is going to be rough, because we got to avoid offending
all right,
Chad.
All right.
Dan, spin this the way you do.
So, let's say we have a player named Chad, for example.
That's bad.
The first thing I can think of is somebody creates a character that the player has no intention of attempting to follow the plot. Now, I'm not talking about railroading. I'm not talking about they're free thinkers or creative thinkers and come up with something you didn't think of.
And you're not talking about the character who's way more invested in his own background than the plot, which is everyone. You're talking about...
I'm talking about someone who sets out from the start knowing the game is supposed to go this way. And rather than being a pal and cutting the GM a break, they intentionally try to take the game 180 degrees in the other direction. Once again, not because it's logical or rational, but just because they can.
Like, say that it's a rootin' tootin' big-fisted combat game and they make the bookworm.
Something like that. We had a guy once in a game, we've mentioned this before, he was supposed to create a character who's an adventurer, and instead he created a guy who owned an inn, didn't want to leave an inn. You could also have a guy, for example, who knows that the plot lies in one particular direction, and instead he tries to bluff the party without a bluff skill into going a completely different direction.
And then yell about the system being bad because he can't lie, even though he has a penalty to his lying skill.
Right, exactly.
It's the system's fault. It's not him for making the character that way.
How do you deal with that?
You tend to just, usually, if you've got good players, they're going to back you up and kind of put things right in the first place by looking at the guy and going, what are you doing? Or you just, like, in my case, when the last time that happened, I just let the system take care of it. Oh, you're trying to bluff your way out of this? Or you're trying to bluff and take us off on a huge tangent? Nope, not going to happen.
I let him run himself off the cliff and then watch while everyone else who's participating and doing what they're supposed to be doing is getting rewards. Not following the railroad. Just developing the plot as it's going. Because there's always some sort of direction.
But, you know, the problem is that one player can be so disruptive and everybody else is trying to get in character and enjoy the setting. And this
player reverts to, like, playing video games in the middle of the game and...
Well, that's not even as bad as just as being involved, but being involved with the wrong mindset. You're not on the same page as everybody else, and you're not actively trying to get on that page. You know you're doing stuff wrong because you've interpreted the setting in a different way.
So you're pulling harder and harder as the other players are actually doing what they need to be doing more and more.
Yeah, that becomes a bit of a pain sometimes.
That's when the OOC discussion occurs.
How much of it is players being problematic, and how much of it is... just have characters who are problematic for the party?
I think you get into a little bit of both in there, because sometimes you have, I mean, I had a guy in one of my groups who wanted to make sure he sat immediately to the GM's right all the time. He wouldn't sit on any other spot around the table because he liked to have that immediate attention to the DM.
And sounds like a dick.
Well, and he wanted to make sure that he, and the problem was that because he had such a tremendous personality, and he didn't talk in tiny font, but he had such a tremendous personality that he just kept coming at you with all these things that he wanted to do, and he kept dominating the game. And it was very difficult to go around and make sure that everyone got their fair shake. But also, going back just a little bit, I don't see anything wrong with humoring that player for a little while and at least trying to do what you can from your side of the screen to push that character where they want to go.
The problem comes when the gentle nudgings don't work. When the player's like, I know I'm doing it this way. This is what I wanted to do. Yeah. And it's like, well, you know, that's completely the opposite of what we're trying
to do
here.
When you go in to give him that inch so that he can turn around and join the party, he doesn't take it. He just keeps walking.
Yeah. Or, you know, you let them have what they want to start out with, like saying, I want something that's kind of outlandish, but it's not going to interrupt everything. It'll be fine. And you're like, well, it sounds like it's going to interrupt everything. Why don't you explain to me how it's not? Oh, well, I'm not going to do this, this, and this. And then they immediately go in the game and do this, this, and this. And take everything further away from where you were going.
Chris, how many kids do you have?
I have four.
You have four kids.
Yes,
all right. I come from a family of four kids as well. I don't have four kids, but I am one of four kids. Tex is my older brother. I've got a younger sister, Christina, and an even younger sister, Rebecca. All right. So let me ask you something, Chris. Obviously, with each of your four kids, am I correct that it takes something a little bit different to deal with each of them?
Go ahead.
There might be one kid that you just have to figuratively or perhaps literally give the beat down to, and there's others where just kind of an angry glare is enough, and there's some where really more positive reinforcement kind of gets them where you want to go. Am I, even if I'm not specifically right, am I generally right?
Each one requires a special method of dealing with them to accomplish what you need to accomplish. Absolutely.
Right. And if you're a game master, players are like children. That's just the way it is. And I have found that a lot of times the way that I can deal with that problem player is to find out not necessarily the specifics of what they want, but the motivation behind what they want. Is it the attention? Is it they have to play something weird? Is it they have to have their own way with the plot? Figure out kind of what it is that makes them tick and find some way to appease that without disrupting everybody else.
As far as I'm concerned, if they want their own way with the plot, they can go write a book.
Well, see, and then,
hey, hang on.
All right. Well, this is what I think we're doing the discussion with the assumption that kick the person out of the group is not the desired outcome.
Right. No. Yes. No, definitely not. But here's the thing. Well, you've had to deal with this too. How did you deal with this exact problem where the motivation was something that, okay, the motivation is pretty much to ruin the game. What do I do?
That's exactly. Well, all right. Assuming it's not. And I've never had to deal with anyone. Well, okay. I've never often had to deal with anyone who had a desire that crass.
Right.
There was one game
where extreme here.
I was GMing with a guy who I fully believe to this day, his conscious or subconscious desire was to undermine my game, was to destroy my game. And I have a couple different theories on why that was that I'm not going to get into. But in that case, there is nothing you can do about it.
Right.
Because you have a human-to-human adversarial reaction. There's nothing you can do about it. What I ended up doing was dropping the game and just reforming the group with some different people. And that's really, really tragic and really sad and just leads to more hurt feelings and stuff. But unfortunately, That's the way life works. Now, assuming, though, the person is doing something disruptive, but they don't have the conscious or subconscious desire to genuinely undermine the game.
Which is probably most people.
Right. I can think of an example where someone in the game maybe wanted to play something really outlandishly weird. I had a guy, we were playing a D&D game where he wanted to play a golem who basically woke up, so to speak, and had some degree of conscious awareness.
Mm-hmm. Don't they have those in Eberron?
Warforged.
Yeah.
Well, when was Eberron written? Because this was
2003, 2004.
Oh, this was way before that. This would have been like early to mid 90s. So we were playing
Skynet the Golem.
I want to say a Forgotten Realms game, and he wanted to play this golem, and he just really had his heart set on it because it was a strange character, and he just loved the concept. And of course, I knew that if I just allowed a golem straight out of the books to come into the game, it's just going to be a freak show character, going back to one of our earlier episodes. He's going to have all kinds of unbalanced powers. This could cause all kinds of problems. But what I kind of discerned from that was what it was he was getting out of playing the character. That he wanted to play, kind of try this concept out of this naive, childlike being who had just woken up. And he kind of wanted to be something unusual. So I found ways that I could tone down the power and kind of fix up his story so he could still get what he wanted without interrupting my game.
And that is, let him play Roy Batty, Nexus 6 Replicant.
Oh, gosh.
Okay.
I got
Maybe
it.
Maybe not. Thanks, Chris.
No, no. I got it.
I got it only because I'm watching it right now, and I've forgotten the movie really moves at a slow pace.
You're watching Blade Runner right now we're recording?
Well, not as we're recording, but over the past couple of days, I've been trying to slog through it, yes.
Well, I'm trying to slog through it. It's the best movie ever.
I'll debate that.
But it's slow. It moves a little slow. But go ahead, Dan. Please continue.
Okay, Dan.
All right. It doesn't have Batman in it, but it had Rucker Hauer in it, so that's still pretty good. And Rucker Hauer was in a Batman movie, so
it's kind of like degrees of Batman.
You know, actually, we ought to start our own Fear the Boot game instead of the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon or whatever.
6 degrees of Dan Ripperger.
Batman. We got to start working down from Batman to figure out how Batman connects to everyone
in
the world.
Given the number of Batman movies out now, that probably isn't terribly difficult.
No,
but damn it, somebody needs to do this. If you're in college working on a PhD in sociology or who cares what, you know, waste management, this should be your thesis. All right, so there you go. I want to see somebody
write the boot. Another public service.
I'm saying the Blade Runner has Daryl Hannah doing somersaults. There's no need for a Batman connection.
She did look really good in that movie. I'm going
She was really young when they cut that. I think she was like 19 or something.
Oh, wow. Well, I was like 8 when the movie came out, but you know.
I was like -2. So who cares?
I used to play Blade Runner when I was a kid.
Like a computer game or
out in my backyard. I had never seen the movie. All I had seen was bits of the trailer and knew it was coming up. And I would just play a Blade Runner. Though I had no concept really of what the movie was. I would run around and hang from things because I saw a scene where Harrison Ford is hanging from like a window ledge.
You would play it in your lawn despite the fact that there's not a single blade of grass in the entire movie.
Did you have gray hair back then too?
I did. Actually, I started going gray when I was 16, believe it or not.
Did you have to put down any of the neighbor kids who turned out to be replicants?
I wanted to put down the one neighbor kid, but I couldn't because he was the one that we had forced to be our DM. So
you know, this is how serial killers start. Kid. You know, the neighbor's a replicant. I have to kill him. This is how it starts, people. You dodged a bullet, Chris Hussey. You dodged a bullet.
I want to run a void comm test at Archon or Gen Con one of these times, but those little contraptions are pretty complicated.
Dan, if I could just play devil's advocate to the point you're talking about just destructive players, because I had a similar situation where we were running a Deadlands Hell on Earth game and had a character. They drove up to a town. They were required to pay a tax to get into town. The character driving the truck.
Yeah, that ever happens.
No, the character driving the truck, he refused to pay. And he was playing his character through and through. He outright refused to play. Eventually, gunplay ensued. And this was just supposed to be a simple thing. You're supposed to pay, go in, and move on to the adventure. He refused.
Players don't like paying.
He refused to pay. And battle ensued, and of course, being the GM, I was throwing as much resources as I could possibly make up at the time at them, and they eventually all but one of the characters died. And though he completely derailed and ruined the game, you know, in the end, afterwards, I was thinking about it, and he was actually playing his character to the best way he knew how. Now, granted, he totally ruined the game, but he was playing his character.
And that's not what we're talking about. the people who ruin the games by either playing their character very silly or not playing any character at all and just playing whatever they feel like that day.
Oh, no. You can totally ruin a game by, I hate hearing the excuse, but it's what my character would do.
Yeah, that is a terror. I'm not saying you can't. I'm just saying that
you're allowed to. If you just hide behind that as this catch-all of, I can be a hole and ruin your campaign. No, that's
how many bleeps do I have to use on this one?
But see, I would almost say that that's okay if he has given previous evidence to the fact that he does play his character that way.
Well, my character would do it is a terrible excuse, though. Your character is a tool to interact with the game world. If you're using it as an excuse to
if your gaming is to get inside this other psyche and to do everything as they would, whether for good or for ill, and that's the simulation that you're shooting for.
But not to the point of where you're being silly. If you're playing a character and you make a bad decision, it's in character, that's fine.
You
but
can
if
make
you're
a
playing,
non-silly bad decision in character.
Yeah, I'm not saying I'm not contradicting you here. I'm just saying that when you use an excuse for things that character would never do. But basically, here's my thing: when players use that to do out of character, use their out of character knowledge in character by saying that's what my player would do. I've seen that happen.
That's a problem.
Let me start before I answer. So let me rule out two answers that I'm not going to use in this situation. Explain why. One is kick the player out of the group, because we're assuming by the nature of this discussion that's not what you want to do.
Right. You're probably at least kind of friends with them.
They're fun to hang out with. There's politics surrounding kicking them out. Like if you kick them out, three other people will go.
They always bring them
on
do.
Right. The second thing I'm going to throw out immediately is making the player fix the problem, because we're kind of talking at this point about how the GM should handle it. So, you know, the player shouldn't do that in the first place. Well, that's true. We're going to put that out the window. So the question I would ask at this point is, as a GM, you have to make a decision. Are you at this point wanting to fight for the game or for principle? What I mean by that is, okay, this guy's not doing what he should do. He's not being a team player. He's playing an obnoxious character. And maybe this isn't even a failure of character creation or group template, because they swore to you they wouldn't do this. And here they are doing it. And Luke's nodding. We've all, if you've ever GM'd, you've been there. And I would say that at this point, if you have to decide, if you're fighting for principle, then you've got to lay down the smackdown. You've got to either say out of character, look, dude, knock it off and deal with the consequences of that. Or you've got to give the person the logical consequences of their action, which is they all get killed and deal with that. But oftentimes, either of those will destroy the game.
Because, well, here's what happens. That player character dies. They make a spiteful player character to bring back in. It's even worse.
Which is even worse.
Almost always what happens.
And this is why what I have found it is better to do is to say, okay, in this case, I'm not going to fight for principle. I'm going to fight for the game. And let some things go, as much as it may irk you to do.
Oh, I never do that.
So, for example,
I'm Rorschach.
Well, hold on.
Until death.
I'm going to give a recommendation here following this that it's not going to be as pleasant. But I would start by saying, he won't pay the toll. They're going to shoot their way through. I'll make this a fight they can win, because if I kill them all, it's going to kill the game. If I chew out the player, it's also going to kill the game. So I'll just smile and nod.
And wreck their truck.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What you do then is you don't kill them, you spank them. I did this to a character in a game. He just was playing this really obnoxious guy who just had to know everything and chase everything, was using a ton of out of character knowledge in character, was driving me absolutely batty. And this was we were playing Skies of Glass before we wrote it in its current iteration. It was a very brutal game, just like Tier 2 and Tier 3 will be again. He was down in a sewer filled with all kinds of waste, we'll just leave it at that, and he just would not stop trying to be a badass. So I had a guy shoot him in the foot. I didn't kill him, I didn't bitch him out, I just had him get shot in the foot.
But then the infection sets
in, and he ends up losing the foot, and suddenly Stumpy's not as much of a badass as he was before, and this really changed things, because it calmed him down without taking him out of the game. And of course, he bitched, pissed, and whined for a while because, oh, my character's ruined. He'll never be the same again. And I was fortunate. The other player's like, dude, suck it up and grow up. You're fine.
You've been playing with fire for game after game after game. Now you got burned.
Your character just got seasoned.
You know, and you bring up a good point, too. It's good when the other players realize this is a problem and can identify at the table like, okay, this guy is doing stuff the wrong way, and the game master's trying to handle as best he can. Let's help him out without looking like we're taking a side here. You know? If you can get a group that does that, which most groups should, you're in good shape.
I don't know. I think it's based off of your frequency of play. If you're in a situation where you don't play that often, then I think you should do what you just described, and fight for the game instead of the principle of the whole thing. But if you play all the time, I go for it on principle then, because odds are, because you play so often, you got a chance to start all over again. If you don't play that often, then you do. You have to just fight for the game to try and keep the game going, because, quite frankly, you don't play that often.
But that's a problem too. Sometimes you don't want to shut down a game just because one player's done something stupid and everybody else is enjoying it. And it's gotten, if they've derailed it or caused so much issue that it becomes something you can't get over, sometimes you do have to end the game, and it sucks.
Well, it's much like Chris says, to put it in a more general term, you have to determine what the consequences of each path is.
Yeah.
Especially if you're limited on time, dropping the principal solution, mm-hmm. it's going to hurt you. It's going to just kill the whole fun having procedure.
Agreed.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And this is a point also where, along those lines, you need to put emotion aside, because the knee-jerk reaction of most GMs is going to be to fight on principle. But you
still can do that.
Well, you can. But I'm not saying it's wrong, but all I'm saying is think it through. When something like that comes up and you're starting to get agitated in one of the players, every game master has an office. Okay, if you don't know what I'm talking about, it has a sink and a toilet. So all you do is you tell
sometimes everyone, the walls aren't very thick, though, right. So you got to watch what you do.
Tell everyone you need to go do some paperwork.
At the bowling.
And if you ask one of the female groups to do this, people are going to think you're a creeper.
So go back, take a moment, think about it, clear your head, and be like, okay, here's what's going to happen if I do this, here's what's going to happen if I do that, and find the option you're willing to deal with. Now, something else I was talking about a little bit earlier, where you can oftentimes take the desires of the players and work with them. An example is...
Aren't you kind of a prostitute then?
Yeah. I've had a game where a player wanted to play this really powerful, frothing, mindless barbarian. Okay, that's all this guy, honestly, God bless him, this is all he was capable of playing. And so I'm trying to figure out, how do I deal with this in the game? Because this is ridiculously disruptive. This is ridiculously destructive to the game. Because you've got one guy just wandering all the time, picking fights for no particular reason. You can't have anything of a plot. So I thought to myself...
If you put fights in front of him, he won't have to pick them. That's how I GM
person. That's exactly it. Or I could do things like start to write something in and say, your tribe has appointed you to protect another party member, and we write some backstory to this, at all costs. And then I give this guy some artificially created fights that I just stick in his way for the sake of letting him vent his rage. But I always keep him on that hook of, above all else, you must protect this one person. And suddenly now I can let this guy be what he wants. And yet sort of, it's like a controlled explosion.
That's pretty accurate.
You can't stop it from being an explosion, but you can kind of direct the way it's pointed without stopping it from blowing up.
That makes sense. Or the character who doesn't want to ever leave his inn will make his inn the basis of... where the adventure starts, where the adventure is planned.
Or a terrible fire.
Or burn the damn inn down at the 30-minute mark.
Yeah, exactly. Well, your very first adventure is a blazing inferno ripoff.
And then you got to go get the guys who did it.
The ripoff.
Adventure made. Written.
Well, and when you think about it, once you incinerate the inn, it's much easier to pack up and put on the train.
That's true.
And you don't have to leave a tip.
Well, the other trouble is, if you ever confront a player about this, a lot of times I've found when they're playing something that doesn't make any sense anyway, and it's just, again, completely on a different page, is their arguments are pretty illogical for why they're doing it. So trying to argue with them, they just don't see where you're coming from at all. Yeah, it's like, look, here's what we said you'd do. Here's what you said you would do and wouldn't do. Here's what you're doing and how you're completely breaking.
And deep down, they know damn well you're right, but
they just keep going.
Consciously, they will never let go of that because they're trying to make a point, or they feel defensive at this point, and you're not going to get anywhere, which is, once again, why I found it's a much better thing. You don't try to stop the river. You just try to reroute it. You let it go. You just kind of try to nudge it to the side. And if you have done this right, if they don't even realize you did it, or even better, if they enjoy the way in which you have done it.
I've seen this happen too many times, though, where that player, even if you reroute him in, which is a great idea and a good technique, sometimes still isn't on the same page, like setting wise and play wise. It's a very serious game and they're making jokes and doing stupid stuff, and vice versa. And you can have
there is absolutely nothing you can do to get this guy online, in character or out of character, with the feel of the game, with the direction of the campaign, with anything, that's when you do have to say, okay, either we don't game at all or he's out.
Or we have to change the type of game that we're playing.
Which may end up upsetting the other players.
Exactly.
Yeah, I agree. And it's, I mean, sometimes maybe you have to do it or want to do it. But generally speaking, I don't like the idea of having to reroute an entire group.
No.
Because
no.
One guy's...
That's a terrible principle to
especially
live life
when
on.
Yes.
The complainer is accommodated for it because he or she complains.
Legislate to the lowest common denominator. Yeah.
Especially
it's a horrible,
if you're a good GM, you're starting off saying, this is what I want to run. Do you guys want to play this? And everybody says, yes, we want to play this serious, moody game that's brooding and, you know, not, it's gritty and not cinematic. And then all of a sudden, guy is trying to do leap on cars and do flips and, you know, do all the
stuff.
Is Fox at a Beth and Rathacon? The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one or the few.
That's right. So if any one of your games is misbehaving,
throw them in a reactor.
Put them in a reactor.
Throw them in a nuclear reactor. Let them go.
Let them get irradiated.
They'll come back.
Besides, humans can actually survive a great deal of radiation without dying, so it'll work out.
How much radiation have you taken in?
Well, you know, not
do
that
they measure
much.
That? I mean, do they like scan every now and again?
For it. I don't know if they
it's in REM.
For anyone who has no idea what we're talking about, Matt's job, actually, he does nuclear hazmat cleanup. So,
I is good for you.
we call it skies of glass research.
He's got one tooth,
it
but it's a beautiful
typing
tooth.
Typing P on your engineer in Civilization.
he looks like Michael J. Fox from Back to the Future with a yellow suit on.
Oh, I thought
you were going somewhere much cooler with that.
That's actually a polycoated Tyvek Mark III suit.
All right, let's move from picking on players to picking on the GMs, because here is something that drives me absolutely bat crap crazy.
Radio that, edit.
That I have seen some GMs do, I cannot stand, which is when they have no idea how to control their players or how to keep you from doing something. Or they've run out of plot, not bothered to write some plot, so they need to drag.
And don't have the stones to just say, okay, the game is only 2 hours today.
Right. And so what they do instead is they frustrate you.
Yeah, just keep putting stuff new. I have a great contrast to this. That actually happened in the game this week that Dan missed. We're in a town. We get in a new fantasy town that the economy is completely based on basically adventurers. So it's a lot. It's a frontier town, pretty much. Prices are very expensive. And we're going to be establishing ourselves here, so we need to make good with the people we're going to be dealing with a lot.
Right.
We're given a decent amount of money to start with. So, while searching for information and meeting people, I'm tipping big. I'm greasing the wheels. I'm making sure people get enough money and, you know, buying drinks, that kind of thing. And I've played, I don't know how many campaigns where this happens. Like, okay, well, I need to make nice with the people, but the GM doesn't want you to, or does it, or it's too easy, so that doesn't matter. Oh, they take your money, but they're still mean to you. They still hate adventures, blah, blah, blah. This week with Dave, it was great. Everywhere we went, a little bit of money went a long way to making friends and getting the information we needed. And it was a great experience that, hey, this finally somebody who gets it, who knows that putting things in your way, if you come about the way you should to get around them, they should get out of your way.
And, you know, a good real life example or sort of an analogy I would use for this is there's a difference between a very long road trip. I mean, let's say you're driving from New York to Orlando as opposed to a road trip that never starts. You're trying to drive between two very near cities, but your car doesn't start. And then it does start, but you back out of the driveway and all of a sudden somebody broadsides you and wrecks your car.
It's really much more annoying to spend 4 hours trying to cross town than it is driving up 55 between St. Louis and Chicago quite briskly.
Exactly. And this is the thing that I would talk about with games where I have played in many games where the game master doesn't seem to have a long road ahead of us. So he or she makes up for that by instead frustrating the simplest of efforts that everything you try to do, it's almost predictable. There have been games where I have stopped role playing, and I don't mean just being in character, I mean doing anything. Because, like, I know here's a solution, but the game master is not going to let that work.
And that game master is being extremely reactive. It's somebody who doesn't have a plan. So soon as they find out what the players are doing, they're like, oh, well, this stops you. All right, well, this stops. It's great. Another, 15 minutes till you tell us what the solution is so we can move on for you to stop us again?
Exactly. I want to run 8 games for this campaign. I don't have 8 games of material. I only have 1. So we'll have half a game at the start, half a game at the end, and 7 games in the middle of just frustrating everything you try to do. That everyone you try to work with will backstab you. Every time you finally found the princess you're looking to rescue, she's in, another castle. And every time that every time you finally get a gun you could use to win the day through, it jams or it has no ammo. And so you just spend the entire game not on a journey, but just trying to get the journey started.
But then, Dan, you get into a situation very similar, you know, where almost anything can happen. You say, well, I'm going to flap my arms and fly away. You know, you get into a situation where, and I've done this before, it's my character says, well, I'm just going to go sit in a tavern and I'm just going to wait until basically something happens because I'm not being able to see anything that's giving me a chance to move forward and I don't feel like adventuring off on my own. So
you can't interact with the world. If you can't interact with the world, you're not playing a game.
Right.
You're waiting for the GM to tell you what to do next.
Exactly. And the point of a role-playing game is for you to play a character to do something and to be rewarded with the logical outcome of that action.
This is the exact opposite of, you know, my philosophy of let the players do awesome things. This is the flip side of that into let's not let the players do anything.
Anything. Not even awesome regular things. Anything.
No, everything gets stymied. And, you know, even if the system, hey, I made my roll. Oh, you failed. That's not enough. It's like, okay, fine. I guess I'm done here.
And I'll tell you right now, if you're a game master and you've reached a point in the game where your characters have just given up, that's the problem with you. I mean, straight up, I'm saying this as someone who has been there and done this.
Yeah.
When you reach a point where your players are so frustrated, they just shut down. The problem here is not the level of commitment or creativity of the players. The problem is you have frustrated them as human beings.
Yes,
because either they can't find the plot or you've made the plot so linear that no level of creativity can get around your inflexible linear direction.
You know, this is why I hate disaster movies. I cannot stand disaster movies. Because if you think about it, with most disaster movies, really, the plot's pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
Poseidon.
Get out alive.
They're trying to make it a very short distance or accomplish a very simple thing or survive for a very short amount of time. The only reason you get a 2-hour movie out of this is because the most unlikely, absurd, unbelievable things go wrong.
That wasn't like it in Armageddon.
This story's locked. We've got to go all the way around.
A lot of stuff went right there. Well, yeah. Well, in a ship, that will happen. And the people die one by one. You know, it's a fun little story.
I can't believe you used Armageddon.
I know.
Armageddon is an excellent movie.
Of all the things to elevate, it's an example of not this. You choose Armageddon.
There are no stupid little roadblocks in the plot.
There's space madness.
That's a psychological documented thing.
There's diesel engines that operate in space. On robots.
I wouldn't say.
I'm with you, John. Armageddon was a great movie.
Thanks, Chris.
John, did you only watch that movie because you didn't want to miss a thing?
I didn't want to miss a thing. And because it was Go to That or Deep Impact, because there was some weekend back in 1998 that you could not go to a movie theater and not watch a meteor movie.
Deep Impact was much worse than Armageddon, too. It was
really? I like Deep Impact.
I like Deep Impact.
I know you like Deep Impact, Chris. That's not a question.
No, not the porno one. The actual movie. I am going to sink to the level of telling a gamer story.
Uh-oh.
I was running a campaign, and the players had been ripping up the countryside, and basically they're becoming bigwigs by defeating, you know, orcs and whatnot out in the country. But they were all bumpkins. So they were going to the big city.
Wait, they were all what?
Bumpkins.
Oh.
It's a subclass of orc. It's a rare.
I thought you said.
It was in Dragon issue 175.
What did you think he said? I want to hear this.
Nothing I can say on a PG rated.
All right. Okay. A bumpkin with an L?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
I hiccuped right as you said it, and I didn't hear it. Anyway, continue.
So when they got to the capital, I kind of wanted to show them that this was the sophisticated capital where, you know, they couldn't just walk into the mayor's office and intimidate him into doing what they wanted. So I introduced them into the bureaucracy. And, you know, I basically burned up better part of an hour just kind of slowing things down and, oh, you need to bribe this guy. You need to get this sealed. And I frustrated everyone without really giving much flavor. And that was a poor choice on my part. The players still remember that from that campaign.
They always remember when you really screw up. I still hear about the stupid rainbow bridges every time I see a certain group of people. Yeah. We all screw up sometimes, but John actually brought up a excellent point earlier. Is if you're a GM and you've hit that point where you're like, you know, I'm not sure I have anything from here on out.
Just stop
the players have kind of exhausted me. stop. Just call it there.
It's really clever when they beat you real quick.
It's better to have a short game than a frustrating game. I mean, I think everyone here would rather watch a really killer 90-minute movie than a really boring 3-hour movie. Mm-hmm. So just this is the moral of the story. Frustrating people does not count as game material because anyone can do that.
It's not dramatic tension in any format. It's much better.
If your notes consist of whatever they attempt, they fail. That's a crappy, crappy game, and you are a horrible GM, and you should be ashamed of yourself.
It's much better.
You don't want to get into a player versus GM thing. It just never ends well at all.
Right.
No. And it's always much better to be the games that the players are going to remember are when you are a facilitator. Again, since Matt and I are throwing around gamer stories, the end of Necessary Evil, you guys come up with this outlandish plot to blow up the mothership, which is going to be like 3 or 4 adventures down the line when they wipe out enough of the enemies to get to it. And what do they come up with? This ridiculously cool idea to blow it up. And it's like, you know what? Technically, this could work. I got more sessions, but you know what? This is a killer end of the campaign.
Right.
So they make the rolls. Bam, it happens. They win the world. Woo! Good times.
Did they give it a virus?
Jeff
Goldblum and Will Smith? Yeah.
Yes, he did. He gave it a virus. He got sick.
He got him one of those.
Luke, I do appreciate you letting us in the that campaign in a cool way.
Well, it's just me patting myself on the back. Well, I'm a repertoire now.
I will say the only way...
Just teasing, buddy.
The only way you could let that happen is because you as a GM... As a GM.
In a gym. Am I truly outrageous?
Well, our ending was. But you were prepared enough to know where the plot was going. So, you know, being prepared 2-3 sessions ahead of time, it gives you a little bit more flexibility. If the players do come up with something really clever or something really dumb, that
or
you know,
both.
That maybe they slide around the encounters that you'd planned for this week. Well, if you've already got next week's prepped, then maybe you say, oh, well, you know, what I had doesn't really make sense, but I've got this backup and I'll just adapt it on the fly.
Yeah. And again, it comes down to planning. If you're a GM who's just like, well, like Dan said, I've got a 30-minute story here and a 30-minute story here. And I'm just filling time in between. You need to come up with a lot more stuff because you are not doing it right.
Right.
Now, on the flip side, sometimes when the players are being, I'm going to say obnoxious. I recall a time back in college where a friend of mine spent several weeks designing this town, all kinds of work into it. The players walk up to the town. Again, they don't want to pay to get into the town, so they just leave the
town.
It is
a running
theme. What is it with you people and paying to get into town? I never make my PCs.
Our Hackmaster campaign ended because we wouldn't pay to get into town.
You have to keep your player characters poor. You have to.
So don't give them gold.
So and this is one of those things where it's a cooperative game. Occasionally, you just have to drop the fourth wall and go, guys, pay the 4 copper or else we don't have anything to do today.
Yeah, there's times where that is appropriate. Don't be afraid to, as Matt said, break the fourth wall and say, guys, look, this is the big hook. Don't do something stupid here. Please, just go. I'll let you do something stupid later. Trust me. You'll have plenty of time to do stupid stuff, but not right here.
You know, before we sign this episode out, I got 2 quick things, real quick announcements.
You got 2 copies?
I got 2 copies.
You got 2 copies.
Shadowrun.
The first thing is, don't forget that Age of Conan, the MMO, is coming out here in about a month. So Fear the Boot is still going to try to put together a pretty big guild.
We are militarizing at this moment.
And John tells me we've got a crossover group coming from something else.
We do. We have a group of my Mudder people coming over, and these are vicious PvPers. I mean, the nastiest PKs you can find on the internet. They'll work under me very, very...
We definitely want to associate it with these people.
Or
then.
Not.
It looks like we're going to have one hell of an army on Age of Conan. So if you're at all interested in that game, please pick it up and catch up with us as it draws closer. We will post on the forums which server won all that jazz when it comes closer. Secondly...
Yeah, wait, if you can upgrade my PC so I could play it on my PC, that'd be great.
That'd be great.
Sure thing, doctor.
Doctors make great. Lots of money.
He's not a real doctor.
I know. That's my
only own practice. All my money goes back.
Secondly, we talked about Icon earlier and the Robin D. Laws Award.
John's, which is right there.
Yeah, John's acceptance speech was pretty damn funny, and we have it on tape. I'm going to try and post it in the show notes of this episode, so please do check and see if it's there. If it's not with this episode, I'll post it with the next one. I just have to track it down because my brother-in-law has it, and he lives about a good ways across town from here. So it may take me a little bit to get it, but keep watching the show notes for the acceptance speech. And it's not safe for work.
No, it's about 25 words long.
Yeah, it's about short enough to be a ringtone, isn't it?
And oh, yeah, absolutely.
It is just not a ringtone you'd want to use at church. And definitely is something you want to check out. So thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
Peace.
Later.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2008, fully owned by its hosts. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.